PPI.org.
Joining into Disability and Progress. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. This is Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research team. Annie Harview engineers. Thank you all for listening. If you want to be on the email list, you may email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Tonight, we're speaking with Emily and Richard Gibbs. Emily and Richard own a company called 64 Ounce Games. And we're going to be talking about that tonight and how it works. I want to start out, guys, by having you give us a little bit of history, just a little bit of history about you guys and what you do outside of this.
Well, I am a life skills teacher, and I've worked with blind students quite a bit in my years as a life skills teacher, and I have knowledge of Braille from that.
I happen to be a teacher of students with visual impairments. I learned Braille when I was in eighth grade, and since then, I just realized that it was my career. So I became a teacher of blind students in my early 20s, and I've been doing that ever since.
So you guys have a company called 64 Ounce Games. Talk about when that started and how did you get the name?
All right. So we started this, I don't know, about 7 or 8 years ago. It's quite a while now. Well, I'm a big board game guy. I love board games like Settlers of Catan, Dominion, obscure board games that you... Now you're starting to see them in like Target, but at the time you really had to go to hobby direct stores. You wouldn't find anything like Ticket to Ride anywhere other than if you were specifically seeking it out. But I've loved those board games for years and years. And when Emily was going through her master's program, especially during that time, we had a lot of blind friends. And one of the things that was always a struggle for me is one of the ways that I communicate, where I like to spend time with people, is to play, whip out a board game and play that. Now, the problem was that if all of our friends are blind, there's a big issue there because they can't actually play the board games that I want to play.
Right. So when we were in my master's program, we had a lot of blind friends, and we started to try to adapt games. And what we realized was it's harder than it looks. Years later, when we were kind of circling back around to it, Richard wanted to publish a game. He's a game designer as well. And so he has his own games he's designed. And we were talking about if we were going to publish a game he designed, we should make it accessible. It should be in Braille as well. And what we discovered then was that companies that make board games don't understand Braille at all. And companies that understand Braille don't understand board games. That publishing and create a game that was Braille accessible, it was on us. Nobody was doing it. Nobody understood how. And it kind of changed the focus of what we were trying to do. Because we, you know, realized right away that it's important. And if nobody's doing it, somebody needs to.
And how did you get the name?
You can cover that.
So, we're big fans of Game of Thrones. We've been for years and years. We have a 15-year-old dog whose name is Sansa. And in Game of Thrones, each family has like a symbol that represents it. And so we were talking with friends years and years ago, and they were like, well, what do you think your sigil would be, or your sign of your house? And one of our friends laughed and said, well, it would be a big gulp cup, because Richard loves root beer. And there we got, went to, well, so the sign of the house Gibbs would be a 64-ounce cup. And from there we got 64-ounce games.
So are you guys visually impaired at all?
No, we're both sighted.
Yep.
Wow. What a leap in some respects. So you guys kind of teach in the fields, but you also make games in the fields.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, you guys are like diehards. So when you guys were growing up, what was that like for you? Were you guys always like, did you guys play a lot of games when you were each young?
My family doesn't talk to one another. We don't do anything with each other except what we do down together and flip the game. And that's always been part of my life. That's what I always think of when I think of like Christmas, is being together with family and playing board games. And that's always been part of our life. When Emily and I started dating, I tried to bring that into our relationship.
It just so happened that when we started dating, very, very early in our relationship, we'd been dating 2 months, when I was diagnosed with cancer. And so I dropped out of college. Richard and I were going to two different schools, but we were only about 45 minutes apart. And suddenly I had to move home. And so now I was 3 hours away from him. And so he would come over on weekends and he would bring board games with him. And so it so happens that Settlers of Catan is one of our favorite games. And it also has a very special meaning to us. He gave me a complete set for our 6 month anniversary. And then after we were married, we bought together the collector's edition set, which has very hand sculpted, beautiful three pieces. We call it our fine china because we don't actually have like special dishes, but we do have this really special board game.
Aww. go ahead.
As I was going to say, in the last couple months, we finally, after we've had this company for, I don't know, eight years, we finally figured out a way to make Settlers of Catan accessible. It's one of our, it's definitely one of our loves, and we offer it on our website. I know that we're the only place in the world that you can actually get an accessible version of Settlers of Catan.
Yeah, we thought it was really important because it's so special to us that we had been planning on making it accessible for years, and finally we got the right technology and the right equipment to really do it justice. We really wanted to do it right.
So if you each had to pick a favorite game that you loved to play when you were growing up, what would it be?
Well, when I was growing up, it would have probably been Settlers of Catan, or Catan as they call it now. We played all sorts of games. I played lots of Risk and but I'd say Settlers is probably the most formative game.
Emily?
I didn't play a lot of what are called Euro games, and that's the particular kind of game that Settlers is, until I met Richard. But growing up, my family and my friends, we played tons of card games.
Ah, yes.
And so I can remember, especially during high school and college, just sitting around and playing card games for hours with friends.
I want to get into talking about the process of making these games accessible.
Well, the process is going to be very individualized depending on what the particular game is that we're doing. So one of the key things is going through the game and figuring out what is important. What is the information that needs to be communicated to the blind players, and that information is going to be identical to any information that the sighted player would need. So depending on how complex the game is, if it has a lot of text on the card, I might have to go to use something like a QR code but it's preferable if I can do it in something simple, simple like Braille. And I prefer not to use technology when doing it, because I think that that slows up the game and prevents it from being
right,
fun.
Right, right.
So I try to do things with like reference sheets and Braille whenever possible, because someone can read Braille a lot faster than they could use a technology to do the same thing. Now, some of our games aren't going to be, well, let me describe exactly what, so once I decide that this game is going to have Braille, what I'll do is I'll type it up in Word and curate it. I might, depending on the game, I might have some abbreviation for some of the things, like if the game uses wood as a resource a lot of times, I might just put a W for it every time, and I'd include some instructions to say, every time you see a W, it means this. Just to speed it up, because Braille is big, and the Braille stickers are expensive. The games themselves come with, we don't sell the games themselves, we sell what we call accessibility kits. And what's in an accessibility kit is basically Braille stickers that people can cut out and put on their card games, and then the since they're transparent, the sighted and Braille reading users can use it at the same time and play the same games in the same way. Some of our games, though, that do have more text might have something like a QR code, and they could use their iPhone or whatever device that they have to scan the QR code and get that information that is a little bit longer and more wordy. A lot of times the card games will have is like, it'll have a picture of a monster and maybe a little paragraph about what that monster is. Well, you don't really need the paragraph to play the game, but it's flavor text, and it can kind of add to the theme of the game or what have you. So if there's a description of a dragon, we'd type up that description, but we'd put it in a QR code, so if the blind player cares, they can grab out their cell phone, scan it, read the same text, and be immersed in the game the same way that a sighted player would be.
Absolutely. Flavor text tends to be cutesy or funny or witty. It's just there to make you smile, but it doesn't have any real bearing on how you play the game.
Right. The biggest example that we have of that would be probably Apples to Apples. It always has a it has the name of the card, and it has a joke associated with the card. Or if it's in a little bit more obscure, like a historical figure, it might tell a little bit about the historical figure. If you don't really need it to play, but if you but players might want access to it while they're playing the game.
Okay, so how many games have you to date done up accessibly?
Oh my goodness.
That depends on how you look at it. We had, like, Dominion, for instance, is a card game. It's called a deck building game, where you have you build a deck of cards as you're playing the game, and every time you play with different cards. One of my favorite games. But in that, they have a lot of expansion packs to it, which are separate purchases. So if you count Dominion plus all the expansions that we support, well, that alone is almost 20 games. And the same thing is true of Smash Up and Munchkin. We offer the game and a bunch of expansions. So if you can't count each one of those separately, I mean, that's
right.
50 games there.
Right. Especially, even Cards Against Humanity has several expansions that we offer. I want to ask, if I wanted to give a guess, do you have any idea? 100, 150 games?
At least. I mean, if you're counting them that way.
So when you decide to do, like you were talking about the kits that you put stickers on the cards, can these people read through the cards? So like if you're playing with a sighted player, they can see through the Braille?
Absolutely. The assumption is that most times it'll be one blind person playing with three sighted friends.
Right.
But that's not always true, because we've had people, blind people who love to play together, and they'll get groups together and they'll play Bonanza or whatever the game is that they particularly like.
Right. Or we have several friends who are a couple, and so we have we know a lot of couples who purchase the games and play just the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Go ahead.
I don't know where I was going with that.
But when you decided to start, like, how did you decide what game to start with at first?
We looked at our shelf. That's pretty much what we did. And we wanted to do the games that we thought were most interesting and most unlike what blind people had been offered before.
Right. A lot of, when you just look at, you know, APH or Maxi Age, you see Scrabble and Monopoly and Uno and Braille cards. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to offer new things that perhaps blind players had never played before, because there's such a huge wide range of games out there, and wide range of genres, and wide range of mechanics. And so the first thing that we really tried to do is we really tried to pick one really good, what's called evergreen game. So a game that never goes out of publishing.
Uh-huh.
Every single mechanics for board games and offer that. And then when we had all of that, then we started thinking, well, I really like this other game, but we should offer that too.
And there's been times where publishers have approached us and said, hey, can you make our game accessible too? And we'll be, and depending on who it is, we might do that. And sometimes we've had requests from blind players, this is a specific game that I'd like to have accessible, and like, okay, we'll do it.
Right. And so we do take requests now that we've gotten going, but that's how we start.
So you talk about doing these kits, and I'm wondering, why wouldn't it be easier if you just did the game and resold it?
Well, the reason we do the kits is a time as we said, we're full-time teachers, so it would be time prohibitive to actually open up and take the game and put stickers on every single card. If you're talking about, say, Cards Against Humanity, well, that's 600 cards in that game. You have to count out 600 stickers and put them on there. And it would be a better product, sure. But the fee that we'd have to charge to actually do that would put it out of the...
right, it would be astronomical. So this way, it makes it easier for us to make. It also makes it more affordable. And for the end user, they only have to put one game together, where if we were selling the game that was already adapted, we would have to do it hundreds and hundreds of times.
What kind of material is the Braille generally done on?
Generally, we use sticky Braille, which is just it's a transparent Braille sticker. However, if we have access to a 3D printer now, and we make things like 3D printed Braille dice for role playing games such as Dragons. Mm-hmm. So depending on what needs the particular game has, it is either going to be on sticky Braille, or sometimes we've done thermoform boards. An example that Ticket to Ride, which has a big board of the United States, so you can actually feel like the Great Lakes or the Florida or wherever.
Right, so it has a big map of the United States. We also, another example would be Pandemic, which is, you know, apt for right now, but it has a large board that shows the entire world.
Right, and with some of those games that really get sprawling, we'll also include like a reference sheet that is smaller, so that the blind person can use the reference sheet to read, oh, this city is connected to this city because they're right next to one another, without the board, just so that they can get an idea of the geography, which I think is a great thing to have the blind players do, because they don't have a lot of experience using tactile graphics or being able to really even see a good map of the United States. So that's one thing that I really love about doing that, is that in our schools, we don't have access to the level of accessible format, tactile graphics, as we should. And that's really unfair. And I feel like some of the stuff that we've done with 64-ounce games can help fill some of those gaps that really shouldn't exist. And one thing that we do, aside from doing the game stuff, is we also make some Braille materials and teaching tools to try to promote the use of Braille and tactile graphics all around, because that's very important. Braille literacy is literacy for
right.
And too often it falls to the wayside because they say it's too hard or something. Right. We do some of, a few of our kits do not require Braille, but the vast majority of them do. We do have some games that you can play just.
We have some games that don't require Braille because they are more suited with different tactile graphics or tactile items.
Again, that's what makes sense for the game. Because like there's a game that has a path that you have to follow called Syrup, and really it's just being able to follow that tactile line.
Right. Even print, there's no words. It's just a line.
Right. So the games that we choose to do that with are the games that it makes sense to do that with.
And is there, I know sometimes what for me, like I do a lot of cards, and I think sometimes Braille can rub down on cards, or they're not as, they don't stay as good. How do you deal with that on your, you know, do you find that that happens and people have to order a new kit occasionally, or?
No, we haven't found that to be an issue. And I think it's because the stickers are more durable because they're a type of plastic. So it, they don't really seem to rub off.
Yeah,
they're rubbed down the way traditional Braille sometimes does.
Yes, I mean, we've done Braille with Slayton Silas's games, as you're just saying. And they'll last for a while with just the cardstock, but not
right.
forever. And ours, right. I won't claim that ours lasts forever, but I haven't had people tell us that, or I haven't noticed the same people reordering stuff.
Right, and we haven't heard that as feedback. And the items that we have that are plastic or thermoformed also don't, they hold up very well.
So how do you decide now, I mean, now you've got a ton of games under your belt. How do you decide how to keep, which way to keep going? What game you're going to pick next?
One of the things that we're doing as a big push initiative right now is there's a series of games which they're not really connected because they're done by a different manufacturer, but they're my first games. So like a publisher will have a hit game like Carcassonne, and they'll be like, all right, this is a great game, but how can we present it in a way that's a little bit simpler that kids can play?
Right.
So there's a bunch of my first games that we've started doing because they're a little bit simpler. The kids can play them, and then they can evolve into the bigger games that adults can enjoy.
Right. A lot of times, even the skills in playing a game, you need to be taught them. You know, turn taking or light touch, going the graphics on a map, even reading a tactile graphic. A lot of those are maybe not necessarily intuitive, and I've met a lot of blind adults who didn't have a lot of experience with tactile graphics and don't understand how to read them because they never had that growing up. And so these My First games are a great way to introduce blind children to tactile graphics and get them playing games and then move into more complicated graphics as they get older.
I'm wondering, guys, you know, there's a lot of games out there and there's a lot of them that have a lot of rules and a lot of this and a lot of that. Are there ever games that you have come across that you just feel you cannot do justice to making it accessible?
Absolutely. And I think as we get more equipment and we get better at it, the amount of games that we can't do lessons. For instance, we didn't feel equipped to be able to make a good accessible version of Settlers of Catan until this year. But we're always trying to kind of refine our process, get new equipment, get better ways to design these kits, and so we can do more and make better quality kits.
Sometimes the mechanics of the game can make that kind of tricky as well. One of the first games that we did, we had to puzzle over for a while, and that's The Resistance. It's a game where you play as a group in this evil dystopian world. It's a game for 5 to 10 players, mm-hmm. and a certain number of those players, depending on the player count, are evil and trying to
actively work against
the Resistance. So they're spies. So one of the mechanics in that game is that everybody closes their eyes, and then the people who are evil open their eyes, so they look at each other while staying perfectly still, and then they close their eyes again. So the evil people know who else is evil, and they can work together to try to foil the Resistance and keep the dystopian future dystopian. Mm-hmm. So we had come up with a way that they could communicate it without giving away to everybody how to do that. And we do that by passing tactile cards under the table. And if you're one of the evil people, you can read the card. But if you're not, you don't read the card. You just pass it without reading it. And it involves a degree of trust. Mm-hmm. We just use a simple X and an O, so even those dumb sighted people can feel which is which.
Right, and it does kind of rely on the honor system, but if you mm-hmm. think of the original ruling where you just close your eyes, it does as well. Anybody can peek. And so, I mean, if you're going to play a game, aren't you going to play by the rules? Or otherwise, it's no fun for anybody.
That's right. What's the point?
And like, if you're talking about some other games, like a lot of people are familiar with Jenga. Creating an accessible version of a dexterity game like that is exceedingly difficult to try to. I mean, you can do a version of Jenga where you wear a blindfold and do it completely tactfully, but that
it would be a different game.
And so at some point you can make modifications, but at some point it becomes something entirely different than what you started with, and you can't capture that same experience. So yes, we there are some games that we just cannot do, because by the time we get something that they can do, it's something else.
What is the hardest game that you've ever made accessible?
Ticket to Ride?
I would say probably Ticket to Ride. Not because it's because it has a big sprawling board, and and I needed to figure out a way to present it with there's a big sprawling board, and there's connections between the cities, and there's a certain amount of trains on each connection, and each train has a certain color on it. So I needed to not only do you need to communicate the names of the cities, you have to communicate what's on the path, how many spaces are on the path, and what color is on the path, all in the area of like in just an inch or two.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those that we designed it and redesigned it and redesigned it. And even today, we're always looking for other ways to kind of make it a little bit better. I just remember so we used our laser cutter to engrave a piece of acrylic with the map on it. And then we go over that map. And so that took a lot of iterations and a lot of making it correct. And I think it was a 12-hour engrave for each of the four quadrants. And so it took 2 days of sitting in the garage, 2 full days.
Breathing in melted acrylic as the laser cutter cut into it.
Yummy.
And you weren't sure if it was going to be right or not. And
right. So he did it once and it wasn't right, so we had to do it a whole other time.
Right. But it's a much better product now. I'm very proud of that product. And if we do any more games with big boards, I kind of want to do it the same way. Our hard ones are often the ones that you learn the most of. Another one that I'm particularly proud of would be Carcassonne, which is a tile laying game where you build the city of Carcassonne, and you build and that's one of our games that doesn't require Braille. I have 3D printed pieces that are in multiple colors and textures and all this stuff that fits together, and they all clip in together, and they have little pieces that fit into the spot. So you have these 1-inch tiles that are 3D printed, multiple different colors, spots for pieces to snap into so that you don't knock them over when you're playing. And getting that right, I print a piece lots and lots of times to try to make sure that it snapped in right and that they would attach to each other correctly. And the game has, at least probably 100 different tiles. So that means 100 different 3D printed tiles that fit together into this beautiful castle and landscape and fields. But getting all of those pieces right, in addition to the pieces that you place on the tiles, was definitely a struggle as well.
Right. I think it's important to note that every time we make a new product, every time we make a new kit, we learn something. And we realize that maybe one of the kits we had previously, we could do better. And then we have to go back and redesign it. So we're always learning and always growing.
Yeah, iteration is a huge part of the whole process. And when we get better technology, we can make kits better. We recently bought another, a different embosser. So one of the things that we're struggling with now is, all right, which one of these kits do we have to do differently so that we can provide the instructions on, what's the term that I'm looking for? Duplex.
Inner point.
So if you had to pick one game that is your pride and joy that you've done, what would it be?
I'd say Catan is one of the ones that I'm most proud of. The ones that I've been talking about are the ones that I'm most proud of, right. Probably.
Catan's my favorite just because it's so close to our heart. We wanted to make it accessible for so long, and finally we have accomplished that.
And I think that Ticket to Ride would be another one that I'd definitely do that, because I, like I talked about, blind people not having access to good maps and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was particularly important to get out. And it's a fantastic game, a classic game, sold millions of copies. And I definitely recommend that one.
Well, Emily, you deal with teaching kids in Braille, right?
Yes.
So do you ever use these games in your classroom?
Yes. I've recently left the classroom, and now I work for a nonprofit, and I do use our games there as well. But yes, before I left the classroom, I was using our games, because I think that playing games is a way that people learn, and being able to play games and teach Braille at the same time, it makes it, the learning of Braille, easy and fun. Mm-hmm.
And do you feel, I mean, it feels like that builds up so many other skills too, including team working together and team building, things like that.
Absolutely. Here in Texas, we talk about the expanded core curriculum, which are kind of like all those soft skills that maybe everyone learns, but aren't taught directly. And a lot of times, blind and visually impaired students don't just pick that stuff up, because it might be non-visual or it might be not directly taught. And I think that games teach a lot of those expanded core curriculum skills.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then working in life skills, definitely we work on that, those skills a lot as well.
Do you have anything as far as I feel like this is always an important thing, and I don't see anything anywhere about it, but I really feel like there should be something that goes out, you know, when parents have kids who are visually impaired or blind, or even if you've got blind parents and you have sighted kids, there's that, it feels like that chain where you might naturally play games with your kids. You just don't know what to do, and what they don't know, you know, they can't know what they don't know, right? So it feels like there should be something that gives them some kind of announcement, hey, your games can be made accessible. But I don't, you know, certainly when I was growing up, I had to stumble upon that and things like that. Now I think it's more out there, but it would be interesting to have schools just have a, you know, kind of your guys' website or something. So that would be something that they would give to parents.
And that's something that we're trying to do. And it's a bit of a struggle because as we both have full-time jobs, the degree of success that we have with 64-ounce games, it's like the...
We want to be successful because we think what we're doing is important. But at the same time, we always think, well, maybe we don't want to be too successful because we're afraid where we get to the point where we're good, successful enough that we're busy. And so busy, we might want to quit one of our jobs, but not
right
enough that we can't actually afford to quit one of our jobs.
Right. We can't afford to quit our job right now with what we're pulling in with 64-ounce games.
Right.
We want to get there someday. And we somewhat jokingly call it our retirement plan because we're not super thrilled with what our retirement's going to be. So if we can do a working job and do some income there, that's where we'd like to be. We'd like to ramp up the business and send out emails to everybody, but getting it so it's is comparable to what our salary would be otherwise is quite a leap.
Right. Can you give us the website and how people can find out more about your games?
Absolutely. Our website is www.64ozgames.com. And you can find out all of our accessibility kits there, as well as sign up for our newsletter. You can also follow us on Twitter at www.twitter.com/64ozgames.
And I want to ask you real quick, on your website, I noticed it talks about you saying you should have the most updated game and that it's harder to do old games. Do they really update games?
Yes, they do, and it drives us crazy.
I just figured, you know, one game that you had from when you were like 10 or 12 would be the same, especially if it's like, you know, I don't know, like
Uno is probably exactly the same as when we were 10 or 12, but the games that they update and make more current are games like the two particular thorns in our side are Apples to Apples and Cards Against Humanity. Because as things change, and as, you know, the president changes or, you know, things become current in politics, they want to make those into jokes.
Right. So, one of the new cards is COVID-19. That didn't exist.
Oh, yeah. That's true. A year ago.
So, when they came out with a new version, we had to go through all the 500 cards and say, all right, is this one different? No. Is this one different? No. I mean, it's a big process. And some of the games, they'll change the artwork because, like, Risk, this isn't a game we offer because it's really, but Risk has different boards throughout history. They're all maps of the world, but they've used different artwork, different artists. And if they use a different artwork or different artist, that means the shape of the board changes and where you need to put the pieces change. And
so we try to offer links on the website to Amazon, because it also depends on what game you buy or what game Amazon is offering. And sometimes Amazon will send a different version even than it offers on its website because they figure they're interchangeable. But for our purposes, they're not.
Right. There's, for instance, I just had one of our games has some 3D printed components, blocked. And there was a family that had a game from 10 years ago. They've owned it forever, and they just assumed that it would be. So they sent me this email saying, look, the kit is okay, but it doesn't fit. It's, and then I look at the pictures, and I'm like, well, of course it doesn't fit. You're using the old one. Let me
put
a new one for you. So they thought that the kit just didn't work, whereas it wasn't that the kit didn't work. It's that the kit wasn't for the version that they had. And they, just like you, they wouldn't have occurred, even begin to occur to them, that they might have different versions. But a big company like Hasbro or Mattel or something like that, they they want to keep their stuff looking fresh on the shelf. So if they rebrand it, even though it's just minor changes, those minor changes can be a big difference in how well our kits fit.
So do you kind of save the kits from the old ones, thinking that somebody will contact you and say, hey, I have this game from this year. Do you have a kit to match it?
Luckily, because all of everything that we make is made to order, we don't keep like a stock. So we can keep the digital files for the older versions of games, just in case.
Nope.
Ah.
Let me get rid of them.
Come on, Jake.
Well, that's a bummer.
Just wandered in here. So, escorting.
That is just how it goes nowadays with Zoom and radio. The whole family gets involved.
Oh, we can barely even fit the whole family in this room. We have 5 kids.
Oh my. Well, plenty of game playing then, right?
Yep, that's for sure.
So what has been your guys' biggest learning thing with doing something like this?
I think that, I don't know if an exact, like, this is the time we learned the most, except maybe Chicken to Ride Again, just because it took so many different iterations and so many different tries, but I know that we have learned so much over the course of 7 years that what we're doing now, even in terms of the way that we organize our file system on our computer and even the way we create games and the way everything has changed so much because we've learned so much doing this. We don't work the same way now that we did 7 years ago.
But I would say the biggest thing that we've learned is that, and we knew this, but we didn't know this, is how much the experience of gameplay has been lost on the blind public. How they have told, I mean, they think that they know games because they've played an accessible version of Monopoly and an accessible version of Uno, and they've tried them and it wasn't their thing. And then they just assume that they're done with games forever. And the fact is that there are so many different experiences. Sometimes there you have games that are cooperative. Sometimes you have games that are competitive. Sometimes you have games, party games. Sometimes you have games that are strategy games and you have to think. There are so many different approaches and different things that that blind people haven't had that experience, that opportunity to do. So they don't know what they're even missing. And that was, I would say that was the biggest thing that I've learned throughout this, is that through the joy of being able to present these things that I've loved for years and years to people who say, I don't like games, and then they actually on games and they're like, wait, what else do you have? And they realize that there's been this huge a thing that they've just never been exposed to and they've never gotten an opportunity to do, because frankly it isn't very profitable to do something like this.
Right.
But I think it's very important to do something like this. And there's been times where I've been frustrated and I wanted to close up shop. But then I think back at 64 Ounce Games, and even if I'm tired and have all this stuff with my other job and everything else, and I'm stressed out, and I think, why am I even doing this? I think about those people who haven't had a chance to do something that I just take for granted, and I think that it's important, and I think that it's so sad that that if I didn't do it, it just wouldn't be done in a lot.
Yeah. People would miss out on a lot. So what's your hope? What's your wish for the future of 64 Ounce Games?
Well, I would like to get it to the point where I could actually step back from my current position and actually make it into something where I could work doing 64 Ounce Games, offer offer everything, more things and get it more widespread. Mm-hmm. But we have a lot to do, and it's a big leap from it being sort of manageable to that stage. And I don't know how and when we're going to make that leap, but it's going to be, but that would be my hope, is that we could do it like full time.
Have you guys ever had any thoughts of actually creating your own game?
Oh, I have lots of games where I'm trying to sell. 64-ounce games could, I originally created it in order to, created the company in order to become a game publisher and publish my own games that I've created. Mm-hmm.
If Richard isn't at work or helping you around the house and the kids, he's playing games, whether it's published games, or he spends probably 10 hours a week on Discord doing what's called tabletop simulator. So it's a computer version of his games that he's created, and he plays tests them with his friends all over the world. So he probably spends, hours doing that, trying to refine his games. I think he has 7 or 8 that he's working on right now and getting them perfect so he can send them to publishers as well. I mean, games are really his passion, and it really matches up well with mine, because mine is definitely accessibility and real literacy. And so together we're really a great team.
You guys have 5 kids, right? You can just experiment on them. Like, get them to play all the games.
They frown on it if we try to blind them.
Oh. Well, this has been I thank you again. Can you please give your website once more on how we can find out more about you?
You can email me at richard@64ounce.com. You can go to our website at 64ozgames.com or ouncegames.com, depending on if you want to type a little bit more. And those would be the best ways to get a hold of us, I would say. Anything. We're on Twitter. We have a Facebook page, and I guess that's the main.
That's the main ways.
Well, thank you so much for being on. Charlene, I don't know if you're unmuted, but if you had any questions, now would be the time to ask. Otherwise, we'll go to our culture piece.
I don't have any questions, but you guys are doing a really great thing, because I grew up in a family of 8 kids, and I always got left out, kind of. And when we played Monopoly, even, I wasn't sure that I was being, treated very fairly.
She was afraid they were taking all the money, is what that was.
So we wish you well in your endeavors.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming on. Thank you very much again. And it's been great talking to you. This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Charlene Dahl is my research team. Annie Harview engineers. We've been speaking with Richard and Emily Gibbs on their company 64OZ, or 64-ounce games. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. Feel free to check out our podcast if you need to and want to, and be on my emailing list at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Thank you.
KFAI.org.